If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that, instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey everyone, it's Yas here, and I'm calling today with a little favor to ask. Over the recent weeks and months, I've had loads of you get in touch with some great questions, and today I'm going to be trying something new with the show. I'm trialing a Q&A segment where I'll be joined by a co-host and elite coach educator, Gerard Jones. Now, these are discussions which are going to be taking place every Sunday evening at 7:30 GMT, live on Twitter Space, if you wanted to get involved directly. Otherwise, I'll be releasing them here every Wednesday on the Coaches Network podcast. So for today's format, it's slightly different, and for around about 30 minutes, each discussion will be dedicated to a question that has been sent in, where myself and Joa will be going into some real depth and sharing our views and opinions on the topic in order to leave you with some key takeaways to consider in your own environments. So the favour I'm asking for today, guys, is if you could let me know your thoughts on the new format, and you can do this by getting in touch on Twitter at TheCoachesNet. Once again, that is at TheCoachesNet. And of course, if you have a question, feel free to send that in too. Hope you enjoy the new format.
The Coaches Network, bringing the game together.
Hey guys, you're now listening to the Coaches Network podcast, a podcast aimed at anyone who's passionate about athlete, talent, and personal development. My name's Coach Yas, and I'm a UEFA licensed football coach developer, and content creator. I'll be sitting down with a range of guests to discuss their journeys, their life lessons, and how you can make an impact. Enjoy.
Yeah, good evening, everyone, or good afternoon. Really looking forward to the discussion. My name's Gerard Jones. I'm currently working as a director of coaching within the youth department at Sporting Kansas City, alongside being a coach educator with US Soccer and a coach developer with the FA, English FA, and fortunate to work in the professional game in England across a number of different roles, whether that be as a head of coaching, under 21 assistant, or academy coach. And really looking forward to, you know, sharing some ideas from the Euros. Can't wait to get started.
Awesome. And similar to Gerard, guys, working across coach development, myself currently working across a range of different qualifications for the FA, as well as obviously founding the Coaches Network podcast. Let's deep dive straight in, Gerard. You know, Euro 2024 insights. We're looking at game models today. Where does your mind go to straight away? Who excited you the most, and who's left you kind of intrigued the most off the back of what was an exciting championship?
Well, first of all, amazing competition, right? And there's probably a lot that we can talk about here. And I want to start off by the sort of clarity of what do we mean by a game model. So, you know, my definition of that, of a game model, would be that it's a framework of our principles across different moments of the game. So the game model, often people can confuse it or perhaps even view it as something that can be quite fixed. You know, my view would be that the game model really should support and guide how we're viewing the players' decision-making based on the principles of the game. So it's a tactical framework that defines how a team approaches and executes its strategy during matches. It's encompassed with the overall style of play, you know, and how we're going to interact with the environment, the principles, main principles, sub-principles, and tactical behaviours that typically go, when we talk about game models, we always can think about these sort of four moments of the game, right? In possession, out of possession, offensive transition, and defensive transition, which can sometimes be limiting as well because it doesn't paint the full picture. So although we talk about these tactical behaviours and even just in simple in terms of in possession or out of possession, you know, what about restarts? You know, what about set pieces? What about other moments of the game that don't just fall into when we've got the ball, when we haven't got the ball, or transitional moments? So I wanted to start off with that of, you know, what do we mean by a game model? And that sort of segues me in really because there's a lot we can talk about here. So with the Euro, so we're only going to, you know, have time to give snippets really, but there was a fantastic example of different teams' sort of strategic intentions around how they want to play. Formation is something that I want to talk about. So formation is different to a game model, right? It's the shape and the structure that a team is initially set up in. And of course, formation is a start position, not a set position, because in animation, the shape can change. Why that's important is because it plays a huge part in players' ability to interact with their teammates, you know, outplay the opponent and solve problems. So one of the things I noticed a lot was that within the Euros, there were so many offensive and defensive structures in shapes that was quite fascinating, you know, across a number of different teams. Like an example, Austria in Gaze would adopt almost like a 1-4-4-2, but then it would look like an animation when they're attacking a one, obviously with the keeper, 4-2-2-2, right? So in animation, it would change, and that would lead to a lot of central overloads because as part of their game model, and in particular, you know, in some of the games they played, you know, I've got one game in my mind against Turkey, they're looking to create those overloads centrally where they've got players who are receiving not only in between but around and behind lines, that it affords a more opportunity to break forward, to break lines, to as you would say, yes, penetrate and have those supporting runs because they're creating a lot of numerical overloads in central areas. And that's something that we notice a lot. So that sort of segues me in that, you know, I'll say a few other things really, is that throughout the tournament, we saw a lot of teams adapt in the shapes and the structures. So, you know, we saw a blend of real adaptability. You know, you look at Switzerland v Italy. Italy, typical Italians, right, in terms of how they want to play and their defensive structures. And really, Switzerland actually playing a lot of backward passes, actually forcing a lot of backwards and sideways passes to disorganize Italy's shape and structure so that it afforded more opportunities to play through. And there'll be a couple of clips that I'll share, you know, even throughout this series where as I'm talking, it can hopefully give people a visualization of what I'm talking about, you know, when I'm saying these things. But that was something that, you know, I've noticed a lot, that a lot of the teams, you know, really adapted how they played. And then just broad strokes, we saw whether it was Spain in terms of their possession-based approach that's typical of the Spanish teams, they focused on using possession to control the game through high levels of possession and very intricate passing. And it's no surprise because when we talk about control, and you could probably even think about the Spain v England final, right, Yaz? I mean, we talked about it even then, you know, back in July, that Spain dominated a lot of the possession, and that was a big part for their tournament, you know, with high percentage of pass accuracy, a lot of short passes to break down defences, with the emphasis on patient build-up. Now, with other teams, it was different. You know, there was more of a direct approach. You know, typically at times, even with Portugal, they would use a direct approach in their play, focusing on wide areas, which resulted in a high number of crosses. I think 25% of their goals came from crosses, an effective use of fullbacks with providing the width and the directness of attacking play. So their tactical intention was that how can they exploit wide areas and attack the wide spaces to deliver entries into the box. So right across, you're seeing a difference, right? Or let's take France. France, you know, in terms of their pressing and their counter-attacking, were adopting a lot of strategies to set traps so that they could recuperate the ball. And again, quick transitions on counter-attack. And there's a lot of statistical data that we'll probably go over in the webinar that I've got clips for where we're regaining the ball in certain areas and there's a certain time limit where they're getting a shot on goal within a certain number of seconds. And that's not an accident. You know, if you look at France's game model, certainly out of possession and how they're preventing progression. So one of the opponent from progressing the ball forward, they would literally, you know, try and create situations where they were regaining the ball. I mean, they had a high number of successful tackles and regains. They actually averaged 18.3 per game. So you can imagine that there's a lot of pressing. You know, you think about the detail of the presses per defensive action. They've got intense presses, typically in the opponent's defensive third. So that influence, that indicates that there's maybe a higher emphasis on high pressing with quick transition to exploit the opponent's mistakes. So you there's lots of little things, right? So I've talked about Portugal and their directness and attacking wide spaces. I've talked about France in their high pressing and counter-attacking. I've talked about Spain in their possession-based approach, right? I've talked about Italy, you know, and even Italy, they used a lot of different shapes and formations, very similar to England. You know, they shifted, Italy would shift their shape from a 3-5-2 and a 4-3-3, depending on the game phase. And England were very similar. We saw from England that they would operate different formations and shapes, completely different to how they played against, you know, Spain in the final compared to the game that they played in the quarters and the semis. So that indicates that not only is, you know, the shape and the formation, the structure of the team important, the way in which the game model is interpreted and implemented has to be adaptable. That's what I'm taking from it. And, you know, just to add a further one as we sort of plant the seed really with where I'm going with this. If we look at a lot of data from the Euros, one thing that we've noticed a lot with our teams is the importance of attacking wide spaces. I think that was a probably trend throughout a lot of national teams where they're utilizing width in different ways. So some teams, give the example of Austria, where they're creating width, but in a different way because their offensive structure in possession is quite narrow, which affords opportunities to penetrate centrally, but also exploit wide spaces in a different way. Whereas other teams would exploit, like England as an example, would play a lot of their possession down the outsides, like a hell of a lot of possession down the outsides, the wide spaces. And that was because of the shapes that we adopted and perhaps how we were viewing the games, you know. So there's a lot there, really. And then I've got some more detail that I can talk about in reference to the final that we'll sort of piggyback off that. But really, it's just understanding that there's difference in how each team applied their game model principles. And it was largely due to the personnel that they've got at their disposal as well, which we can talk about a little bit, right?
Yeah, most definitely. I think there's, you know, there's a lot in what you've shared there.
So I'm just trying to wrap my head around some stuff that's going through my head. And I guess the first thing that comes to mind is you talk about the game model being effectively a strategy. I know the first question a lot of people might have been thinking in some way when it comes to this sort of stuff is, what's the difference between the game model and what is traditionally known as a playing philosophy? And the second one is, in everything that you've shared there, all I'm going through my mind thinking is, well, these are still, yes, they may have some game model principles, but fundamentally you still align to the principles of play. And just really highlights for me again how important those are in terms of, doesn't matter where you play your football, what level you play your football at, effectively your game model is just your expression of the principles in of principles of play in action, if that makes sense.
Yeah, 1,000%. Yeah. No, I think you're spot on. I mean, we talked, you sort of made two points there. So the game model, as I mentioned before, is it's really that framework, right? So often these terms are intertwined and they can cause some, you know, confusion perhaps among people. But game model is really the description of the desired behavior, the tactical behavior that we're looking for on the pitch, that of course contains a number of different things that makes it up, right? It has to influence it. The game idea in terms of how we want to play, you know, our philosophy, which is different, the principles, the sub-principles, and then of course the individual actions that players, you know, do to perform that. I mean, the playing philosophy is something that's totally different. That's your intention around how you view you want to play, like your style of play, if you like. And some people might have a belief that they want to utilize possession purposely with intent, where they believe in possession to outwit the opponent, to create certain opportunities to exploit their defense. Other people might prefer a different approach, right? Their philosophy and the way in which they view the game might be more based on countermeasures and making sure that they're nullifying the opponent and trying to find ways to regain the ball to counterattack and exploit the transitions, and the philosophies based on that approach. So it really depends on a lot of it's probably preference. I don't know if you would agree or not, Yaz, but there are cultural things that exist. You know, England is very different to Spain, to Italy, to Austria, to Germany, to France. We're built differently, aren't we? You know, and we've got different ideologies, and there's also sort of social, cultural influences that shape why we play the way we play.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. I think, you know, it's interesting though, obviously, as the game evolves, you know, how much, I guess, some nations are, or just teams in general, how some, you know, depending on which country they come from, how much they are maybe really closely aligned to what would be the stereotypical expectation for that nation, or the, or, you know, or characteristics from those nations, right?
Right.
And, you know, the perception that then is given and then challenged by maybe the spectators and the football enthusiasts as to whether a team should or shouldn't be doing that. Because, as an example, if you look at England, for instance, you know, historically known as a team that is probably a bit more direct. Obviously, we didn't really see that, and we haven't seen that for, you know, I'd probably say quite a few years now.
Yeah, it's changed. It has changed massively.
But there is, you know, there is still sometimes where you see it in games, and even, you know, in the murmurings around the games, around whether teams of the more, you know, the more recent teams anyway, whether there should be moments where they actually do go long like the previous teams, and a bit more direct like the previous teams, because maybe they are overplaying it and things like that. So it's interesting.
Well, it depends though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It depends, doesn't it? Because you've also got, like, when we think about the England v Spain final, right? We've got a lot of technicians and we've got highly proficient players, but arguably, I mean, we were outmatched in a lot of ways, at least how they played the game. They were outstanding in how they controlled the rhythm and the tempo of the game, right? And they controlled the ball to attract in order to eliminate pressure, break lines. And it's very difficult, even though we want to possess the ball, and that requires a lot of energy as well. Sometimes we can't always match people with the same sort of effort or the same technicality. You know, I heard a lot of people on the sideline, probably you sort of pub people, if you like, where they're like, oh, why aren't we pressing higher and things like that? You know, England, Yaz. And they probably forget that a lot of these lads, similar to obviously many players in the Euros, but a lot of these players have been playing at high levels. And yes, they're involved in teams where they're pressing more or they're in control more in different ways. But, you know, we had to conserve a lot of energy. We had to actually, Southgate had to adapt his tactics a lot of the time based on not only the opponent, but, you know, the energy level of the squad, which is why, although it might be, you know, frustrating for some fans to watch where they're thinking, why aren't we doing more of this or more of that in certain games where they defended a little bit deeper to try and conserve and, you know, disrupt the opposition. It might be frustrating, but it's perhaps, you know, tactical intelligence of playing to your strengths. I mean, one of the things that I've analysed as a trend across, when we talk about game model trends across the Euros, was, of course, high pressing and counter pressing. You know, many teams did adopt high pressing strategy to disrupt build-up when they could. But the use of counter pressing, I think, was probably the hallmark of how teams are really aiming to regain the ball quickly and capitalize on a mistake after immediately losing it. Can they stop that opponent and get it back? And even, I'll give you another one, Yaz, actually being intentional around where they lose possession. So playing balls in certain areas, knowing that there's a likelihood that we'll probably lose it, but it's in an area where we do want to regain the ball and it's going to cause more hurt to the opposition. You know, I talked about possession-based play and Spain in particular. I think the tactical systems and how teams were fluid in being able to interchange that was quite good. We probably noticed a lot of teams utilising the fullbacks in different ways, with many teams using them as wide playmakers. You know, often the two and the three were involved in a lot of attacking and defensive transitions by creating overloads in the wide spaces. Particularly teams like Sweden and Germany exploited that trend a lot. And then you think a lot of teams, high lines, which if you're having a high line, let's take Belgium as an example, or Austria at times, who employed a high defensive line to sort of compress the space vertically and use that offside trap as a defensive tactic. That's designed to force opponents to make mistakes, right? So they can capitalize on the speed. So there's loads of things. And then, you know, as I say, game model, you know, we often talk about in possession and out of possession. What about some other things, Yaz? You know, what about set pieces? What about kickoffs? You know, those are... Oh, sorry, before I go on to that, actually, you know, thinking about England and in particular, you know, that England v Spain final, there's some interesting data, which is that within when we were in the game, it was very clear that, you know, when we talk about Spain versus England and Spain's ability to control possession, I'll share a couple of data points with you. So first half, England spent a lot of time without the ball and they had to react and press on different triggers, which most would agree. And the pressing data supports this, right? First half, we made 30-odd pressures and forced Spain backwards 11 times, which is a fairly high success rate. Only 5 times was Spain able to play through us and beat the press. But then you think second half, England pressing Spain, Spain actually played through, so around 30 times we're pressing them. On those occasions, Spain actually played through more than 11 times, which suggests that, you know, they're breaking lines and they're playing through a press irrespective of how well we're pressing. And a lot of that was down to a couple of things, really. One, the adaptability of the Spanish, right? They knew that they were able to interchange. There was a lot of rotational movements. Nor did the shape change and the midfield shape change, right? But they were creating a lot of rotational movements, both centrally and wide areas, that meant that it was very hard for England to recognise what triggers to press on. And that led to a lot of ball progression, if you think about a game model. So again, these have implications, don't they? Like, how does that influence how you want to coach? How does that influence your view on the game, how you want to practice? You know, some fantastic things here, isn't there? Yes. And then, you know, obviously it'd be great to get people's insights, anyone's questions on the Euros. You know, feel free, if anyone's got any questions, you know, raise your hand. I do think it's probably worth noting, you know, the importance of kickoffs and set pieces and even how teams use substitutions. I mean, there's so much we can take from the Euros that is fascinating. I don't know if you've got any questions before anyone jumps in or I add something else.
Yeah, no, I'm just thinking out loud then, you know, I guess one question is kind of coming up my mind, and I'm trying to put myself in the mind of coaches maybe listening to some of the insights that you've shared so far, and it's, well, where do I start with the game model being something that I base on how I want my teams to play, or do I base it on it being a response to the opposition and what they're expecting to do? Because this is often the challenge, right? And especially for the coaches who maybe have lesser insights than others, in terms of, depending on what level they're playing at, having access to understanding what the team might be able to do and why what they may be likely to do based on what they've done in the past, if that makes sense. You know, where do they begin with that? Does that make sense?
No, it doesn't. Could you repeat that?
Yeah, so from a standpoint of, you know, when you're deciding whether to adopt a certain approach or have a certain game model, so to speak, should coaches be maybe looking inwards within themselves to say, right, these are the players that I've got in at my disposal, as opposed to being prepared to play directly for the opposition, if that makes sense?
Well, I think the game model is your framework, right? So if you've got your principles of breaking lines, playing forward, finishing different ways of finishing, or counter-pressing, you know, preventing progression, whatever it may be, or securing the first pass on offensive transition, it'll look different for every team, you're right, based on your personnel. So you should really consider, you know, what are the strengths of the group that I've got at my disposal. But ultimately, you know, it's just my opinion, it should really be that it's based on the players interacting with the environment. You know, there shouldn't be any set pattern or rule of how we do certain things. It should be more that, hey, you know, these are our principles, but based on our personnel, maybe to answer your question, to your point, is that if we've got certain players at our disposal, we can execute these principles in several different ways, can't we? You know, if you've got, I mean, take England as an example, with some of the players that we had at our disposal, when you've got so much attacking quality, you know, in midfield and in attack, and you've got the ability for players to play in different positions, which we spoke about on previous webinars, and players actually being played out of position, having players that, you know, in midfield will interchange positions, although Declan Rice is typically a little bit more deeper, right? Almost like a six. But having players who can interact and move, they're gonna vertically attack or horizontally attack based on who their teammates are. So yeah, I mean, it's a long about answer, but yeah, I think you should look at your personnel 100%. 100%.
Yeah, no, so I guess, yeah, you know, I mean, I would agree with that. Again, I just wanted to kind of get that question out there, just kind of see what your thoughts were on it and where maybe coaches could get some considerations from, because fundamentally, your personnel is going to dictate that, right?
Well, what's your idea? Like, as a coach, how do you want to play? What is when you have the ball, when your team has the ball, how do you want them to try and attack? How do you want them to try and defend? You know, how do you want them to, I mean, a massive thing that was pretty cool actually to see in the Euros was the ability of teams utilising set pieces in such a different way, which was good, or utilizing substitutions. So you're drawing on a point there around excuse me, around personnel, right, Yaz? And you're saying, you know, how does that influence? Well, this is a key that if you set your team up and you've started the game, and you know, you're thinking about how are we going to attack in this moment, when you're making a change to impact the game, players have to be on the same page, don't they? I think it's absolutely incredible that from the Euros, we saw a utilization of 90% of the subs available were made, you know, and there was a lot of strategic substitutions. So there was over 100 goals, around 120 goals, right, were scored around across the tournament. Substitutes actually contributed to 30% of those goals. You know, 20% were scored by a sub. And we've got examples that even from England, famously, to get to the final. And the other 10% were from assists that led to the goal. But some of this really, really, you know, fascinating when we think about subs was, you know, the detail in when they were coming on, how they were coming on, how they changed the momentum of a game, the impact of a game, whether it was affording the team to be more direct, whether it was affording the team to take advantage of more set pieces, which is a moment within the game model, whether it was a strategic one for PKs, whether it was a strategic one for entries into the penalty area, to how we're finishing the attack. You know, one of the striking moments, one of the best moments, right, was the semi-final for us between Holland and England. You got Cole Palmer, you got Ollie Watkins, who are brought off the bench right towards the last 9 or so minutes of the game. And it's obviously 1-1. And within that period of time, Cole Palmer's assisted Ollie Watkins to score the winner and get us to the final. And we've had several other moments of that. And I think that's a key thing that, again, looking at teams, and one of the most successful teams utilising subs was, it's no accident, Spain and England were among the best for utilising subs. I don't know if you knew that, but and that to me is like, well, wow, there's something there, right? So if you're thinking about game model, if you're bringing players on, and typically a lot of the stats says that most of the subs came on after the 60-minute mark. And in fact, so over 80% of the subs came on after 60 minutes, Yaz, right? But there was an even larger percentage, an interesting detailed percentage, where they're coming on with even fewer minutes to go. So like literally in the last minutes of the full time or extra time, what's the impact you're going to have? So the impact value of that substitution has to be high in order to change the game, right? Or influence the game to progress to the next stage. Well, that has a huge interest in, you know, how did the game model change when we brought certain players on, you know? So I think these are things that coaches, again, do you think about that? Are you bringing subs on for sub's sake? Or are you looking at it going, well, actually, you know, we can utilize this sub in a different way because it's going to change our principles of how we're reducing space from the opponent, or our principles of how we're exploiting space in and around the penalty area to attack. What are your thoughts on that, Yaz?
Yeah, my mind just goes to you straight away. It's almost like having your subs involved as part of a plan A, plan B, and maybe a plan C, depending on how the game's going, how the opposition are presenting. Because obviously, you know, there's, especially at the top end, there probably is a lot of research, a lot of, you know, prep going into what the team that you're going to come up against is likely to do or what they've historically done. And then you get to a situation where, you know, they might surprise you. They might show up differently. And you've seen it in some of the biggest games, right, where managers decide they're going to do something slightly different. And, you know, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, we only find out at the end of the game. So I think it's interesting. You know, you have to kind of prep for that, right? What is your plan A? What's your plan B? And how aligned are those two plans to, I guess, the overall way in which you want to play, but understanding that the personnel fundamentally linked to your previous point will dictate how that is then expressed as part of the principles.
Yeah, I mean, and it's funny how we talk about like plan A, plan B, plan C. With the subs, they were always used in positions where most people might think, right, we're trailing a goal, or we need to score a goal, right? We're tying and we want to see if we can get the winner or whatever. Let's bring a sub on, or we need to get more freshness of legs. They weren't necessarily used in those generic ways. You know, Spain actually used the most amount, you know, 97% of the subs that they had available, they used, which is fascinating. And they used them in a lot of periods where they were in control. So if you think about the game insight, most of the time for Spain, they were actually in winning positions during the game. 86% they were winning. So Spain only made, I'll give you another stat, they only made 5 subs from a position where they were drawing during that time, like drawing in the game, the state of the game, from a drawing position, but proceeded to win both games with substitutes scoring the winning goal in both of those games. England in the final, Germany in the semi-final. So to me, that's fascinating. And Spain never used a sub at any point when they were losing. So that you could argue that that's an example where, right, it's how do we, it's not necessarily like to change the plan or go plan A, plan B, plan C. It's how can we go A plus? You know, this is a plan A, and how can we evolve it and make it even better? Do you know what I mean? I mean, they scored a lot of goals, and, you know, Spain scored 15 goals, right, in the tournament. And we saw a lot of goals in the tournament this year. 40% of Spain's goals were either being scored or assisted by a sub. So that tells me that they're already in a winning position. They're already dominating a game. They're already having players make an impact within their principles. And then they're bringing people on to take it to another level, to advance it to another level and still achieve what they want to achieve, which is have an impact. So the consideration there is, how are you going to think about using your...
If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that, instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CareCare is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Clubs differently for the future. Do you plan enough of it, right? So do we... Often we use subs, especially in the youth development phase, right? I don't mean phase, sorry. I mean in the player development stage. I should rephrase that again. We're always player developing. You get what I'm saying? With the young kids in general and sort of grassroots development academies, we're always thinking about using substitutions to sort of ensure that there's equal playing time and players are getting opportunities and that type of thing. Well, here's an opportunity where, yes, I know it's from the sort of elite performance stage, but actually as a consideration for your coaching, how can you plan the timing and the moment, the context of your sub to elevate your game plan? So if you've got this specific game plan that you want the players to execute, have you got players on your bench that will actually take it to another level? That's, to me, is a different way of viewing the role of the sub in moments. And there's other examples when we talk about game models, how during kickoffs, certain substitutes were brought on to impact the kickoff that led to an equalization or whatever. You know, and we saw that in games where teams are going down. You know, years past, there was always that stigma of when you score first, you're more likely to win the game. Well, actually, in this tournament, and again, England are probably a good example of this, going a goal down probably meant you were more likely to win that game or proceed in some way, because actually they'd come back in a better fashion. That's quite fascinating, isn't it, Yaz? So it just goes against things that you know we've always been told.
100%. But I just want to just pick up on an earlier point you made around, you know, planning for subs. So I guess, from your perspective, you know, you referenced it as taking it to another level. I mean, I would probably put a slightly different view on it. It might just be semantics, but just, you know, taking it in a different direction rather than another level, because it sometimes does change the strategy of what you're doing when you bring on that sub, for different reasons, of course. But I guess my question to you would be, what are some of the considerations that you'd want coaches to start to think about around when the right moments are and what the consideration should be around in what ways they may want to think about adapting based on the substitute that they've got. Bearing in mind it is youth development predominantly that coaches are listening to, it's going to be working in rather than, you know, at first team or senior level.
I think the principle or the sort of concept, if you like, is pretty much the same in that you can use the sub as a way to carry on information or pass information on. So, for example, if you're identifying something in the game that you think could be tweaked or need fixing, and you're looking for ways to impact that, setting players who have had an opportunity, especially in youth development where it can be roll on, roll off subs, having them as observers, you know, we're fortunate that the coach isn't the only analyst on the sideline, right? Do you know what I mean? Like in some environments, you've got people who they are analysing the game or they're viewing the game and making analysis. No, we've got players on the bench that are analysts. You know, if you're coaching at 7v7 and you've got 10 or 12 players on your roster, you could have between 3 and 5 analysts on the sideline. Do you get where I'm going with that? Yeah, like, you know what I mean? Like, and yet same for 9v9, same for 11v11. So actually what we could do is we could use them as an opportunity where they can see something and they're providing feedback to who's coming off, but they're also providing feedback to who's on there to influence that unit that they're playing in, and they're having an impact, you know. So they it might be like, are they a match winner? So we're setting them challenges. So we could make this of like, your challenge here is, how can your assist lead to the next shot on goal? Can we see more shots on goal in the next 5 minutes when you come on? And that's their challenge. Or it could be, hey, are you an energizer? So when you're coming on, are you helping us because we're not pressing as much? You've noticed that in the first half. You're going to set the challenge and lead that press from the initial trigger. So your ability to jump on triggers is going to set the press for everybody else. And they're telling players, hey, show inside, show outside, or whatever it may be. So they're energized in another way, right? So that we can give the subs different roles that means that we're more intentional around how we're using them, but we're also intentional around their role. That language plays a huge part in this, doesn't it? You know, and for years, I'm sure you've used this in the past. I certainly have, where I've never really said subs. I've said we've got starters and we've got finishers. So these guys are the starters and they're starting the game. But when you come on, you're the finisher. You've got to have an impact on the game. And it makes it so that, you know, of course, Ollie Watkins and players like that, I wish they were starting, right? I wish we'd have used him more in the final, perhaps. But and these guys, you know, when you see them when they come on and some of the other players, they were frustrated, weren't they? Like, it's well documented. They're like, oh, they didn't want to come on with X minutes to go. But it shouldn't necessarily be seen as a negative. Like, yes, everyone wants to start, even at the top level. We all want to start. Kids want to start. But it actually could be a positive that, no, you being a sub allows you to observe the game from a different vantage point and come on and be the hero in this story. Do you know what I mean? So I think that's one that we could do, certainly for the listeners in particular at youth development. Using subs where can it be linked to someone's learning? So we might be using subs in a way where we're playing players in positions and then let's say 70% of their positions played in a position that's one of their strongest positions, a primary position. And the 30% of the game, they might play in a position that's a developmental position. But that could link to a change in our game model. So take Spain as an example when they changed their shape. Spain, very quickly in the Euros, they made a change in midfield and they switched, right? Which I think most people can agree with. And that had an impact because, you know, initially you had Rodri in there, right? And I think he got injured, I can't remember, but I think so. And then they went from, instead of being like a 1-2 in midfield, they went to a 2-1, right? With Ruiz dropping back alongside Rodri's replacement, that Zubimendi. So that's an example where somebody's come in and it's changed the structure of the team, but then it can also be used as a, like you could take this into youth development. Let's say you need this kid to get better at receiving with pressure from behind. But he's fantastic at when he does turn, this kid on your team, he plays through balls, right? And you're noticing that the opposition, they're leaving too much space in between the back line and the midfield. So you might change the shape. And instead of going with a 1-2, you go with a 2-1. And this player who not only needs to deal with pressure from receiving behind and they have a number 6, the opposition, you could put that kid in as a number 10. But now you're also playing on the strength of when he does get into positions where he's face forward, he can thread those balls in. And that might be his challenge. How many times can your pass lead to an entry into the box? And then all of a sudden we're creating more vertical penetration, more breaking lines. And that could lead to more success somewhere else, right? So there are just a couple of things that I would think of is, you know, seeing it as a positive, seeing it as setting challenge and giving players that come on, it's like, this is your mission for now. What's your thoughts on that, Yaz? Any other strategies you've done in the past?
Yeah, I'm thinking it's a great idea. I think it is, you know, it's really, I think this is just highlights the importance of building those relationships with your players and making sure they understand their strengths and areas for development and more specifically about their role in the team, and not because they haven't got the skill sets to do otherwise, but it's, I guess, letting them in on the idea of how you're bringing everyone together and I guess the ingredients that they each bring to the recipe, if you like, because I think that's the key thing, right? It's just understanding, because most players, they'll want to start the game, which is completely understandable, but then it's just getting them to understand with if you have got it to hand, the data to support where they've been most impactful, and I guess framing it for them in a way where you want them to maximize their impact, and here's the evidence that suggests that this is where they've been most impactful. And that's not to suggest that they won't get opportunities elsewhere, but you want to really maximize the use of them in that game. Now, obviously, it's very hard to sell that to a player when they're coming on for the last couple of minutes, but you know, we've seen it in the past, right? Not just in these championships, but in previous ones, where certain players have been brought on very late on because of the intention of they're going into extra time or they're about to enter into a penalty shootout. I mean, I think even if we go back to when Louis van Gaal was in charge and he ended up swapping the goalkeepers over for the penalty shootout that was coming up, you know, there is times and places for these types of changes to take place. And I think, for me, I don't think there's any additional strategies I'd probably throw in there beyond what you've shared, but more specifically around just highlighting the importance of building that relationship with the players and being transparent about how the players are going to be utilised. Because I guess if the players are left in the dark, so to speak, then it's more likely that they're going to become disengaged and less motivated to perform when they are called upon in those moments. So I think that's probably it for me. But I think just a quick reminder, obviously this is an FA accredited CPD session that we're running here. And, you know, there is an opportunity for you to get an hour CPD following a brief post-session survey. And if you haven't caught the whole conversation here, not to worry. You can listen back to it. It will be available on the Coaches Network podcast Wednesday morning. So if you haven't had a chance to listen to the full conversation, then, you know, feel free to kind of check that out. As long as you complete your CPD, post-session survey, by the end of the calendar month, that should be registered. And clarification on that, the hours do get submitted at the end of the month, and usually take about 4 to 6 weeks to get uploaded onto your fan accounts for anyone with an English FA registration. So, Gerard, maybe just a brief insight around that process from your side in terms of the form and everything else.
Yeah, I'm going to share a link now so that everyone can complete the self-reflection. I'll send it after, once we've concluded the space. And really just an opportunity for you guys to put in there, what are the key takeaways for you? So we are monitoring it. We're monitoring the comments that people submit. If you're looking to use this as an opportunity to, you know, reflect, great. If you're looking for this as an opportunity that you want to gain an FA CPD, then make sure you put in your fan number. So your full name, your full fan number that's associated with your account, along with reflection and email. And that'll allow us to review it. And then upon completion of that, you'll be eligible for 1 hour CPD from this space. And then at the end of the series, these will be submitted through Yaz to Middlesex FA, where it will take a little bit of time, but within a few weeks after that, will shortly be uploaded and reflected onto your fan profile. So, yeah, I don't know if there's anything else on that, Yaz, or even, you know, there's lots here. Is there anything that people want to ask or curious? You know, any questions people have got? We've obviously talked about different game models across the nations, things that were observed, some key considerations. We've delved into many different topics. Is there anything that people are unsure about? You know, take this time now to feel free. It'd be great to hear from you. Well, we've still got a few minutes. And maybe, Yaz, just while people are thinking, you know, I'll throw this one out there. There's some interesting data around the attacking wide spaces based on the Euros. And even if you look at it, assist locations. And I think that's something that's changed. You know, and typically we've noticed this trend probably even from the Champions League, but now there's a lot more assist locations where the final pass is coming from central areas, as opposed to going back several decades ago, it was typically get the ball out wide and across in. Whereas now there's a lot more entries from central parts of the field and even half spaces. And I think that is a interesting stat, whether it's inside the box or slightly outside the box. You know, 56 of the open play goals featured an assist, and they came from these areas. That, for me, then is like, right, and I'll share the graphic with people now so that you can visualise what I'm talking about. So if you imagine the penalty area, the box, and then a space outside of the box in that central space, that's fascinating because that's where that assist location looks like. How does that influence your practice design? Are your activities relating to that scenario? Where can we train our players to get better at playing the pass or the dribble into the area from that location? You know, how are we going to develop players' knowledge inside the box as well as outside the box? I don't know what your thoughts are there, Yaz.
Yeah, and I think it's a great point. I think even just linking back into, I mean, I was delivering on a course today, and I think one of the key things that I touched on there was that it's really important to get the pitch geography right, not necessarily in terms of markings and, I guess, spacings in terms of where the lines are and direction you're playing on the pitch itself, because obviously we understand the limitations that come with not having a full pitch and having the right spaces in that respect, but making sure that whatever activities you are doing, whatever practices you are deciding to implement, they are, you know, aligned to the distances and, I guess, areas that the players would be working in. So, for instance, you know, if you're working with a back three, well, think about it. Have you got the necessary space that they require to be accorded, you know, appropriately challenged and face the scenarios that they would face in a game? If you're working with a back four, how would that influence your practice? If you're working with a back five, you know, is there enough space for them to be able to actually be stretched and challenged in terms of moving from side to side and having to step up and drop off it and as such? So I think it's really important that we look at not just what the players are trying to do as part of the game model, but what's required for that to occur and what's required for the opposition to actually cause the problem that they are facing that you're intending to work on as well. So I think there's really... probably the key bit for me is looking at that in terms of having your model in place, knowing what you want to see, but actually understanding what it takes to make that work and stop it from working, if that makes sense. There was just one question that was left in the comments as well, Gerard, you know, just around strategies for buy-in from players. Don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, just look at that now. Interesting strategies for buy-in when implementing your game model. So I would say trying to use clips that you can relate to. So really sharing little snippets of an example, whether it be from the Euros or from their game, and talking about this with the players, right? Whether it's having them do their own analysis or talk about what they observe, what they think we can do better, using it as an opportunity to really paint a picture visually. So you can share clips of top-level best practice as well as clips from your own performance as a way to sort of paint, well, here's what the current problem is and here's what the desired behaviour is. So it might be, let's say you find a situation from your team and you're playing against a certain team structure defensively and you're struggling to break it down and they're very compact, they're defending close to their box, they're in a low block, whatever. You might go, okay, look, we're losing the ball here and this hasn't, and you can show that, right? And then you could show a clip of an example for a moment that you found and it could be, wow, this is how the other team solved it. And that could be used to inspire players. You know, I've done a lot of things like that. We'll do a lot of framing at Sporting. We'll frame the session beforehand. So we'll have players, I mean, we're fortunate. We've got obviously good facilities. We can go through in the meeting room in beforehand, the training session. We can show them tactically on the TV and things like that. If you haven't got those accesses, there's no harm in sending stuff for people to watch. You know, a lot of people watch stuff on the phones now. Sharing the session plan beforehand. I think with your game model, actually having a discussion about what you mean. So if we use terms that the kids understand, that's going to get buy-in, right? If we're using certain terminology, I'll give an example. I think I mentioned this on a previous space, but I'd never used the word or heard of the word Duke before. I don't know if you have, Yaz. I've never personally used it, Duke or to Duke somebody. So in my language, I would refer to like, can I play with disguise and deception? Can we disguise? Can we deceive? And that was a quality that I wanted to go after in the practice, where we're finding clever ways to deceive the opponent, whether it be with a pass or another action off the ball, to trick them, right? And with this group of players, deception, does it relate? And I asked him, how would you... I explained what I was talking about, and I gave a couple of examples. I showed him some clips, and even just on the practice on the field, you know, we're going through stuff. I said, how would you call this? And they said, oh, juke him. You could juke him with your run off the ball. Or you could do... They used another term, actually, where it was with the ball. And I was like, right, okay. So even using terms like that and then talking about that in the game, and it might just be one word or a two-word thing, these little bullet points, but that can instantly paint a picture of a thousand words in the mind of the player. So I think that's a real clever way of getting buy-in, because you're using their language and then it becomes shared language or a common language. I think often we forget that. We always try and impose our language. And there is a value in that, right, in terms of educating them along our way. But really, we've got to be careful that we've got to bring them with us along the journey. You know, so how do we bring them with us, as you're alluding to in your question? So I would suggest talk about, you know, if it's breaking lines and ask them what they think. They may like that. They may come up with another strategy or another term. And, you know, it could be as simple as play through, play around, play back, play over. Or it could be play between, stay between. I've done stuff where I talk about rotational balance a lot. How do we rotate? How do we change positions? And a word we use as a game call is empty and fill. So we talk about empty and fill, which the kids instantly know, right? And that was their words. So then that became part of our common language. Or another one was hide and seek. So I would often, you know, I think about, right, can I play on the blind side of Yaz? Can I get my shoulder across his shoulder? Can I recognize when to run off him and things like that? You can use that, but I would say, hey, try and hide and seek. Well, everyone knows hide and seek. Do you know what I mean? And it was such a playful way of going hide. So get in a position where you can't be seen and then find moments when you can seek and look to get on the ball. So this could be just a couple of strategies that you do that gets buy-in. And then the biggest thing with buy-in is, as Yaz will say as well, I'm sure, is success. You know, when you say something and it has an impact, it immediately builds credibility with what you're doing. And I think that's part of just finding those moments.
I think you're spot on there, mate. And I think for me, you know, I just started working with a team recently, and I've adopted a strategy with them, which a lot of them were skeptical about. Even, you know, just to give some context, I'm working as the first team coach of the team, but I'm not managing the team. So I'm working with the manager, and even the manager himself had a few doubts about the strategy itself. But I said, just be patient. You know, let's see what I'm trying to tell the players to do, and let's see whether they're actually implementing it before we knock it. Because it's very easy to turn around and say, oh, something's not working or whatnot. But I think the first step is, are the players actually trying to implement the idea that you're going after? And then you can really assess whether it's been successful or not. And I think the key for me in those moments is exactly linked to what you just said. Once they start to see the impact of it, even if it is in moments, that's where you start to build your credibility and your buy-in around the strategies you're going after. Because if they don't see the impact of it, then it's always going to be difficult. So it's always, you know, I think that the best way to describe it is, you know, you're just selling a lie. You're selling a lie to them until they can see the truth behind it, right? So they're just going to keep trying it. And you've got to make sure that you keep enforcing it. For me, I think it's just making sure there's clear messages that the players can implement. And it isn't necessarily in the cases of they're going to do it all the time. But if you can capture it in some way, whether that's getting a clip of them doing it, whether it's a recording a moment of them doing it, or just even going through what I like to do with a lot of the time with players is, right, I think going through a process where you give them the strategy and you give them some insight on, I guess, loosely using the word prediction of how you anticipate the opposition to kind of respond to it. And when they see that that's how the opposition have responded to how they've implemented the strategy, then that in itself can get you some buy-in if you're not able to get the the footage or clips of the game itself. So I think that's a real big one for me. I think just linked to what you said, just they've got to start seeing the idea having an impact. And the sooner you can get that to happen, the sooner you can buy into it. But I think another great way to get their buy-in is also encourage the idea of them asking questions and probing on your ideas and be comfortable in being able to answer those ideas for them. I think many a time where I've seen coaches work with players and they bring in ideas, sometimes the players do question them and the coaches don't always necessarily have an answer to the question that they're being asked, which can pose a challenge for the coach in buying that credibility from the players. So those are the key things that I think about myself. But I don't know if there's any final thoughts from you, Gerard.
No, you've nailed it. You've hit the nail on the head. And it's hard because obviously a lot of this comes with experience. I mean, I see it even with coach educators. You know, I used to see it even as a coach, as a student coach on a course, and then I'd see it more being the guy at the front presenting, where sometimes people will be asked a question and if they are limited perhaps in some of their experiences, they just don't have the answer. And they're mumbling around or they're just stuck and they don't know how to respond. Like they can tell you what, but they can't tell you why. And it's a challenge. And the only way you can get around that really is just gaining more and more experiences. Just expose yourself, try things, try different things, see what works. You know, and if we're providing experiences, if we're really thinking about designing activities and training environments that are creating experiences for the players, through game-like, inquiry-based learning, we're not going to do much harm. You know what I mean? They're going to play, even if we're not quite getting it right, and you can do the same activity over and over again. You know, I've seen a lot of coaches where they're like worried, oh, will this get boring? I do some of the same activities all the time. It's never boring. The kids love it, and there'll be little tweaks here and there. But a lot of the time, it's also for me, selfishly, like, they're guinea pigs in a little way. You know, they're getting something out of it and they're definitely benefiting because they're playing the game, you know, so that it's not doing any harm. But then on the other side, I'm learning, do you know what? That time constraint didn't work, or that challenge that I did there, that wasn't the best challenge I should have done. That didn't work. This challenge worked better there. And you do the same session several times. You almost become an expert in that different activity, but you learn so much. So I think and being exposed to different games, you know, where you try things and it's not always going to work and come off, right? But just having the confidence to try things. And I know that's easier said than done, you know, and really you've got to be fortunate that you're either in a position of influence and power or, you know, you've got a very good mentor, head of coaching, director of football, whatever the title, who is the boss that either isn't around all the time or when they are, it's not that they turn a blind eye, but they acknowledge and they support you. You know, if you're in an environment that's okay to fail and make mistakes, then you're going to do well, aren't you? Where it's not, there's not that huge pressure on, you've got to get it right, you've got to win. But actually, if there's a you know, just put the pressure on yourself. I don't know what you think to that, Yaz, as a last point.
Sorry, could you just repeat that? I didn't quite catch all of it. Joe, can you hear me?
Yeah, sorry. Did you get what I said or no?
Yeah, I didn't quite catch all of that. So you mind repeating the last point?
Basically just saying that, you know, really just gaining different experiences, that's how you're going to become more knowledgeable and better at making decisions, right? And having the answers of why. So if you get asked the question,
yeah,
you don't just say the what, you say the why, because you know you've lived that experience.
100%. You know, one thing that, to add, that, well,
and you've, yeah, yeah, and just, but if you've got people that can support you, because I think if you're in an environment where you try things, but then your boss is like, whoa, 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 then it's going to be very difficult. And it's a fine balance between trying to win the game, trying to do the best thing and get everything right. And you've also got to learn as well and grow.
100%. I think just to echo your point about having a range of experiences, I think that range of experience is also beneficial to you work across different environments.
not just getting different experiences within the same environment, work around different coaches and different players, because you'll start to see that obviously the different players take the information in different ways, and always try and find out what they've been most impacted by through your coaching. I think is a really good one. You know, often, I mentioned this point today actually when I was delivering on a course, and it was just saying that, you know, at the end of the session, the most common question was, all right, what did we learn today? Well, it's probably not the best question to ask. I think the best question to ask is, you know, or rather, the question isn't what did we learn today, it's what were we working on today? Well, you kind of already know that, because that's what the session was about, that you planned. So you shouldn't really have to ask that question. I think the question you need to ask is, what were their takeaways? What did they take away from today's session? Because what you want to know is, well, what impacted them the most? And if you kind of dig in a little bit deeper, in what way did it impact them? Was it the way in which you landed the message? Was it something they saw? Because these are all the bits of insight, right, that you're going to get and gather to kind of add to your armory around how to work with the players, what messages land in what way, what messages might need to be adapted to be a bit more clearer and provide more clarity for the players. So I think that bit is just as important. Don't just think, yeah, I'm going to spend more time on the grass. You know, obviously that's a great way to kind of get more experiences, but it's about the reflective element to it. How are you observing and assessing your impact? So that would be the final point for me. And Gerard, maybe just a reminder about the link to the post-session survey.
Yeah, I'm going to share this now, the link. If you can't, as soon as you see it, you know, if you're looking to use this, as I said, to gain some FACPD, it looks like a few people have completed it already, actually, from before. Just make sure that you fill in your full name, the space that we're doing today, which is game models across nations. So put that in as a title of the space that you've attended. And then from there, make sure that you put your full name, email address, and fan number in order to gain the FACPD. And just complete the self-reflection task. It normally takes an average a couple of minutes. And we use a triangle, circle, square reflection model. You don't have to answer all three, but it might just be you focus on triangle, which is what are the three key takeaways for you. Some people complete all. Circle is what's still swirling around. What are you not sure about? And square is what's really squared off and made sense to you. So when I share this link, just complete the form. That'll enable you to be up to an hour CPD. And then from that, Yaz, anything from you last in terms of hours, you know, when that typically, I know we briefly mentioned it before, but when it'll get added in that type of
thing. Yeah. So hours will typically go on at the end of the calendar month. Obviously, we've got a webinar on the 1st of September. So it'll go in the week of the 1st of September on this occasion, just to save us sending multiple communications through. So effectively, you've got until the 1st of September to get your CPD hours done for anything that we do in the month of August, including the webinar itself. But it's just really important, guys, when you fill in that the post-session survey, to make sure it's fully complete. We've had people in the past who've completed the survey with just their name, their fan number, and left everything else empty. If that is the case, obviously you won't qualify for any of the CPD that we were able to accredit on this one. And that will apply, obviously, on any space going forward as well. So get onto the link that Gerard's about to share. Make sure you're following us. If you've got any questions, or if there's any particular things that you want to hear us speak and discuss about in the future, then please let us know. Because fundamentally, look, we're here to try and support the coaching community, try and make it as impactful and as useful as possible for everyone. And obviously, for those that are eligible for it, try and get you accredited for some CPD in the process, because it can be a challenge. So slightly different in the way that we do it, obviously, on the spaces. You're not having to attend a webinar, you're not having to attend a face-to-face event, although those do have much value in them as well. So don't just rely on the spaces that we're doing, but, you know, try and engage with us in many different ways, because there's a lot of opportunities to get, you know, further accreditation for your CPD hours, but just generally looking at your development as a coach. But yeah, that's it for me, Gerard. You know, unless there's any final thoughts from you, I think it's probably time to say goodnight.
That's perfect. You know, have a great rest of the evening or afternoon. Hopefully try and take some ideas from it. There's a lot, you know, definitely try and listen back to it. Look forward to implementing these in your environments. And yeah, can't wait to see you on the next series.
Awesome. Take care, guys. Have a great evening, and we'll be back next week.
Well, there you have it, guys. Another episode of the Coaches Network podcast, where our aim is to bring the world of athlete, talent, and personal development together to just one platform. And you can help us with that mission right now by sharing this episode or any of your favorite episodes with everyone that you can think of. You can tag us in those mentions as well on Instagram at The Coaches Network or on Twitter at The Coaches Net. We look forward to hearing from you. Let us know what you thought about today's episode. And until next time, guys, take care.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Terms and conditions apply.